Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning, everybody. Lee Cattell in for Rick Sengary on Vermont Viewpoint today here on WDEV. Rick's got some family in visiting Vermont for the first time, so he's going to spend the next few days showing them around. And in the meantime, I get to sit in and chat with you and a couple of very interesting guests today and Monday. And we've got a busy show for you this morning. On the way today, in about 15 minutes, we're going to chat with Michelle Hogan of Josh's House, which is a location in Colchester that is designed to give veterans the opportunity to gather and enjoy fellowship. And so they've got a cornhole tournament coming up to benefit Easter Seals and Josh's House. And Michelle Hogan, helping the folks at Josh's House, will join me at 9:20 to talk about that. After the news update at the bottom of the hour, Scott Hoyt is going to join me. Hoyt is from the Hoyt Family Farmstead in Tunbridge. You might have read the story at VT Digger earlier this week about cows at that farmstead that were killed when they were eating field that had been contaminated by wire left in the field as part of a broadband expansion project. And Scott's going to join me to chat about that at 9:30. At 9:50, we're going to get Bob Ney in for our national roundup and talk about the latest developments on the national scene. And then in the next hour, Robert Haidu, who is teaching a seminar with the University of Vermont Continuing Education Program about the history of capitalism. So we're going to go back in time for 500 years to see how we got the economic system that the United States has been using for so long. That's all part of Vermont Viewpoint here on WDEV. But joining me right now, we're going to start the day by pickling ourselves. Bring out the brine. Here comes Kyle Staton, who is a small batch team member for Southern Recipe. You're going to be talking about pickles on this month of July is National Pickle Month. Kyle, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. How are we doing today?
Well, we're doing really well, and it's National Pickle Month, and of course, this is the time of year when people are doing the barbecue thing, hot dogs and hamburgers, and well, nothing really adds flavor to a hamburger than a tasty pickle to go right along with it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So every single July is National Pickle Month. You know, it's the month to really celebrate, you know, everything pickle related. And here at Southern Recipe Small Batch, you know, we're foodies at heart. So anytime that we get to celebrate big, bold flavors, you know, like pickles, and talk about how to, you know, indulge in pickles in different ways, especially, you know, using our pork rinds, for example, you know, we are definitely in. So we're excited to be here today.
So let's talk about the concept of pickling. How far back does it go?
Absolutely. So the mighty pickle, you know, so many different variants of the pickle itself, is actually over 4,000 years old. There's actually some facts out there that go back to say that historical figures such as, you know, Julius Caesar and Cleopatra were actually the ones that, you know, first started talking about the pickle. And then this popularity in the old world actually led to the pickle not making its first appearance in, you know, North America as it is today until 1492, which is actually, you know, the same year that Christopher Columbus had traveled here. So he's actually the person that introduced pickles, you know, to us here, you know, in the United States and North America, which is just absolutely crazy to think about.
So Christopher Columbus not only allegedly discovered America, but he also brought the pickle here.
Absolutely. He absolutely brought the pickle here as well. And then if you're, you know, kind of fast forwarding a little bit, you know, one of the recipes I have today and one of my favorite ways to enjoy pickles is actually fried pickles. You know, they've been coming extremely, extremely popular over the last few years, and it's something I, you know, crave from time to time. And, you know, that invention actually didn't get its first, you know, form in print until 1962. So this was in the Oakland Tribune. There was a recipe that was printed for French fried pickles. This recipe called for sweet pickle slices and pancake mix, which is actually a little bit different than today with your traditional breading. So just crazy to see how far the pickle has come, you know, over these 4,000 years.
The first time I ever had fried pickles, I was in Baltimore. I had gone with some friends down to go see the Red Sox play the Orioles down there, and they had some fried pickles. I believe there's a restaurant across the street from the ballpark where they had them. That was the first time I had them, and they're good with a little ranch or blue cheese. Definitely can enjoy me some fried pickles. And, you know, as Americans, we learn how to deep fry just about everything before too long. If we can eat it, we can deep fry it.
Absolutely, absolutely. That actually brings me to my next point, you know, eating and, you know, fried pickles and everything. It's actually said that Americans eat on average about 9 pounds of pickles a year. And then, you know, taking that a step further, the largest cucumber ever grown was actually 3.7 feet. And then later this was actually pickled, you know, in a saltier brine, you know, turned into a pickle. So this cucumber was technically the largest cucumber and the largest pickle. And I don't know about you, I stand about 6 feet tall, and if I had a, you know, pickles next to me, that is more than half my height. Just like imagine that. It's absolutely incredible.
I don't want to think about that at the moment, but hang on. Now, so when the pickle was first invented, has it always been derived from vinegar as a stock that it is soaked in?
Yes. So typically it is soaked in a salty vinegar brine. For example, one of the brines that I've used in the past is 1 cup of water, 3/4 cup of vinegar, and then a tablespoon of just salt. And then what I typically do is, if I'm, you know, turning cucumbers, pickling them, I put them in a jar with about 3 cloves of peeled garlic, as well as 2 larger sprigs of dill that you just have in the jar with your cucumber slices, whether they're sliced long ways or thinly.
So those, when we're asking for best practices when making homemade pickles, include a little garlic and some of these other items, maybe a little dill seed in there?
Yep, just to kind of really, you know, dial in. You know, I'm a big, big fan of dill pickles. You know, those are my favorite type of pickles. So that's why I kind of reach for the dill, putting that fresh sprig in my jar, as well as some garlic cloves, just to kind of give it a little bit more of that pickle taste that a lot of people search for.
Now, on the 4th of July, of course, they have the annual hot dog eating contest on Coney Island. Is there a pickle consumption competition?
That is actually a great question.
That's why I make the big money here to ask the great question. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I am not sure, but if there is not, I would definitely be interested in competing in that. I watched the hot dog contest this year, and I'll tell you what, I think that I could take a run for its money with some pickles.
Now, Southern Recipe Small Batch, I believe they can be found at your local Shaw's, which we have Shaw's stores here in Vermont. Yeah. And now they've got a product, and we've got northern sensibilities here in Vermont, and this this product that you're talking about here today, it feels like it's got a sort of southern flair to it. Southern Recipe Small Batch Air-Fried Pork Rind Pickles. How do we make those?
Absolutely. So our air-fried pork rind pickles recipe, first and foremost, you know, you're going to need an air fryer. That's what we use for this recipe. It's super, super easy. You only need to put it in there for about 5 to 6 minutes until it's at the level of crispness that you need. So all it is a mix of, you know, it's going to be a mix of sliced dill pickles. That's what we opted for, as well as about a tablespoon of almond flour that you're going to mix in with crushed pork rinds. If you wanted to, you know, opt for your standard sea salt and cracked black pepper, you could do that. Or if you wanted to go for a, you know, extra pickle crunch, you could actually use our spicy dill pork rinds that already, you know, are made with dill, garlic, and vinegar with just a little bit of heat to really add to that breading. So you're going to take these three things, mix them in a bowl with some garlic powder, and this is when you're going to, you know, dredge your pickles in that egg and almond flour coating, as well as your pork rind. So your standard, you know, breading anything, whether it be chicken, you know, pickles, anything that you're frying, using the egg, the pork rind breading, and then cooking in the air fryer just for about 5 to 10 minutes. So all in all, it should take about maybe 15 minutes to complete the recipe. And I'll tell you what, there are days when I am sitting here just like thinking about going to the kitchen and just making this recipe. It is so good. And the best part about it is, with, you know, our pork rinds from Southern Recipe Small Batch, I know they're high protein, low carb. So, you know, if you have someone that's maybe, you know, doing the keto friendly diet, you know, they are keto friendly. So it's super, super easy. And, you know, there's so many different creative things that you could do with these fried pickles.
I never diet. What does keto friendly mean?
So keto friendly is typically a diet that consists of eating a higher level of fats and proteins, not as many carbs.
Oh.
So it would be like, yeah, it's eating less carbs, almost no carbs. So, for example, our Southern Recipe pork rinds have about 1 to less than 1 gram of carbs per serving, and they're mostly just going to be 8 grams of protein with a very little fat.
All right. The Southern Recipe small batch air-fried pork rind pickles. So find them if you can at your local Shaw's Market. Now, of course, everybody thinks of the cucumber as the most common pickling vegetable, but you can pickle just about anything, and including, you know, once you've used that garlic to flavor up your pickles, that pickled piece of garlic is usually pretty tasty too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, you can pickle anything. I mean, you could take just your standard vegetables. You could take, you know, some carrots maybe and dice those up and mix those in your brine as well, and everything's going to have that pickled taste depending on, you know, the level of vinegar, salt, and then if you have these extra ingredients like the garlic or the, you know, sprig of dill in your jar, it's all going to just kind of take on that taste. I will say just the most important thing when it comes to pickling anything is, you know, of course, the longer you keep them sealed in the jar, the more powerful the flavor. But really, you know, for me, I'm someone that really likes that crunchy pickle taste. You know, you bite into it, you hear that crunch, you know, that's what I'm, you know, looking for. So you don't want to leave them in there for too long to where the pickles or the other vegetables actually become limp. So this is why, you know, we typically recommend picking a smaller or firmer cucumber to slice up rather than, you know, a large one. For example, like the cucumber that's 3 feet huge, I mean, cutting that up, just the thickness of that is going to be a little bit harder due to it retaining so much water. So that's why we opt for those smaller, kind of firmer, if you're really after that pickle crunch, so to speak.
Well, Kyle Stanton is in his – these are the salad days for Kyle Stanton because it's National Pickle Month in the month of July, and you sound like you really appreciate them for everything that they are. National Pickle Month
Absolutely.
Is July, and what's the website where people can find these? You can probably buy them online, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You can go to southernrecipesmallbatch.com, or you can find us at Shaw's. This recipe's on there. All of our flavors are on there. And then if anyone is looking, you know, this summer to participate and potentially win some free pork rinds, we're actually supporting Ian Munsick. He's an up-and-coming country singer. His tour across the United States, and people can enter to win up to a year's supply of Southern Recipe small batch pork rinds.
Oh, if that's the case, that would make every month pickle month, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Kyle Stanton, I appreciate you giving us some time here on Vermont Viewpoint this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a good rest of the day.
That's Kyle Stanton. It's National Pickle Month here in July, so soak them if you got them, in vinegar, that is. Right now, we welcome in Michelle Hogan from Veterans Count to talk about an upcoming event to benefit Easter seals. We've already talked about eating pickles as part of a summer pastime. And of course, the cornhole is another great way to spend your time in the summer, throwing those little bean bags through the holes. And there's a great event coming up where you can win cash prizes. And Michelle's joining us right now. Michelle, good morning. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Thank you so much, Lee. I'm glad to be here.
And by the way, all you folks out there that may want to dial in and chat with any of our guests this morning, you are invited and encouraged to come on the phone at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Michelle, you're with the Veterans Count. Talk a little bit about what they do.
Veterans Count is a program through Easter Seals Vermont. We work with the veterans and service members, anyone currently serving, no matter how a veteran was discharged, no matter how long they served, we serve everyone. So we provide gap-filling services, basically things that a lot of organizations can't or are unable to handle. So we do everything from preventing homelessness for our veterans and service members by taking care of their rent payments, if need be, or their mortgage payments, and helping them get back on track. We also pair them with a care coordinator, who is a wonderful direct support worker that works through Easter Seals, Military and Veteran Services, and works one-on-one with veterans or service members, helps them with anything from applying for different services to getting budget help to, you know, figuring out transportation, all of those kinds of things. So it's really a one-on-one program where we meet a veteran or a service member where they are, and we kind of try and help them, and we say we give them a hand up, not a hand out.
I think a lot of civilians here in this country underestimate what a veteran, what a military member may go through during the course of their term of service. Not only are they required to put their lives on the line and face death in combat situations, many of them, but, you know, you also have to deal with the person on the other end of your fire. You don't have to just have to deal with the fact that you may be killed, but a lot of right. veterans have to live with their conscience. And even though the narrative is it's war and you're supposed to take somebody else's life, that can be difficult for people to deal with when they come back home or even when they're still serving in the military.
Absolutely. And the thing is, too, is that we do ask so much of our veterans and our service members, but then we also kind of expect them to get back into regular life when they come home. And that's easier said than done. A lot of times there's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of transition to be done. And many times a veteran will come home and they're kind of just like, okay, well, here, take a break and then head back out and just be a regular person again. And that's just not really how it works. So we're doing a lot of work. Also, this cornhole tournament we're talking about is benefiting Josh's House, which is a wonderful, wonderful resource through the Josh Pallotta Foundation in Colchester. Any veteran, any service member, can come in and just kind of relax and meet with other veterans and hang out and maybe talk about some of those issues that are so important to those who are transitioning after having served in the military and for however long, you know, whether you served for a minimal amount of time or for most of your life, you know, having those resources, but also, we have found that a lot of veterans who help us through both at Josh's House and through Veterans Count are maybe veterans themselves, and they remember those times when they transitioned back, and they know how hard it is, and they want to help. So, this tournament benefits them too. We have this great program, this great kind of resource network of veterans who remember what it was like and want to help. So it's really a great situation where people who need help can come in, but then we also have those veterans who are like, yeah, I've been there. I can reach out and help these men and women too. So I think that's been probably the most impressive thing that I've seen since I started working with Veterans Count a few years ago.
How long ago did Josh's House open?
Just recently. They just finished construction on it. So I don't know the exact day they opened, but it was just within the last year for sure. And it's been such an amazing thing to watch them do. I was up there recently and they just have so much for anyone and they're looking to maybe someday even be open like all day, every day. But right now they're open every day. They have people who donate meals. They have a meal train that comes in. So you can just come in, you can grab a snack, you can grab some food, you can watch TV, you can use your computer. Andrea, who's in charge of, or who works at Josh's House, relayed a story about just a veteran who's a stay-at-home dad who just needed a couple hours of quiet and had this great resource just to be able to go and sit and work for a little while. But then, you know, they meet up, they have classes. I'm thinking about doing some dog sled demonstrations for them next, this coming winter. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on there and it can be as much as a veteran wants or as little.
What do you know about
really
Josh?
Cool. I know that he was an amazing young man who went through some troubled times after he came back. His mother tells his story so beautifully. So I almost feel like I'm doing it an injustice, but he absolutely struggled and, did take his own life, which is how the Josh Pallotta House, got started.
And so this event is coming up for the Cornhole Tournament. Give us the where, yep. when, and what's at stake.
Absolutely. It's two-person teams. $50 entry gets you a potential grand prize of $500. We also have a second prize of custom cornhole boards. And I'm still working on the third prize, but it'll be good. Don't worry. And it's August 7th at the Josh Pallotta House. Bags fly at noon. Registration starts at 11. There is an Eventbrite page where you can buy tickets or do your entry. And then there's also a Facebook page. So you would just have to type in. It's called the Fire in the Hole Cornhole Tournament for Josh's House and Veterans Count.
And that's
so on Fire in the Hole.
That's on August 7th, and Josh's yep. house is on Hegman Avenue in Colchester.
Absolutely, up in the Fort Ethan Allen complex up in Colchester.
And is there a website for Josh's house?
Yes, it's joshpallottafund.org, and then VetsCount is vetscount.org.
All right, Michelle, our time has gotten away very, very quickly, but I really appreciate you giving us some minutes this morning. Saturday, August 7th. Is the Cornhole Tournament, and one more time where people can go to find out more?
I would say go to Facebook and go to Veterans Count Vermont, and that would be perfect.
All right. Michelle Hogan, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm Lee Cattell, filling in for Rick Zingary on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Coming up next, we're going to check in with Scott Hoyt at the Hoyt Family Farmstead in Tunbridge. You're listening to WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Lee Cattell filling in for Rick Zingary. He'll be back on Tuesday. Joining me on the line right now is Scott Hoyt from the Hoyt Family Farmstead in Tunbridge. Scott, good morning. Welcome to the WDEV airwaves.
Good morning, Lee. Thank you.
First of all, how many cows do you have at your farm?
We're about 140, 135, 140 head, depending on the year. We got 60 milkers and 70 or so, a little more than that probably now, heifers and stuff, a couple bulls.
How long you been farming?
2018 is when we bought the farm from my folks. They moved there, I think, in 87. So it's a family tradition, kind of carrying it on.
How you like it?
Liked it. We loved it. Obviously, going through the things we're going through right now, it makes it really difficult, and you know, farming's not easy, so we're just trying to survive at this point.
So you're in the daily routine of farming there at your farmstead in Tunbridge, and all of a sudden you started noticing things. What started happening at the farm?
So I guess I can give a little backstory. So I know we hay the same hay fields. My folks have been doing it for probably the last, I don't know, 25, 30 years. We custom hire a feed from a farmer in Washington, Lambert Farm. They come down with a self-propelled chopper. They've been cutting the same fields two or three times a year for the last, you know, decade or so. And then, usually what happens is they come in the spring, midsummer and kind of early, late summer, early fall. And then they turn around and, we make bunk feed and silage and put in our bunks, and kind of after the Tunbridge Fair, we kind of open it back up and start feeding out that feed for the winter months until we can turn our cows back out to pasture. So we had done that, the fall of 2020, around September, we opened the first cut bunk of feed, started seeing a piece of wire, thought it kind of was just a random, you know, one-off piece of wire. And the H-bumps we'd feed out after the cows had gone through and ate their meal. Then it became multiple pieces of wire, and that's when we started reaching out and contacting people and see what was going on.
Did you notice that the cows were starting to different things in the herd that were happening that you noticed before you saw the wire?
No, wire came first, and then we knew we had a problem, and then that's why we started contacting without the parties involved and contacting our vet and, you know, agency of ag and trying to get ahead of it and figure it out and what was going on and why this is happening. That we've never had issues in our feed, you know, for as long as my parents cut the fields, you know, as long as, you know, Lambert's cut the fields. I mean, their self-propelled chopper has a magnet that if it's magnetic wire goes anywhere near it, it shuts it off. And that has to be engaged before even lets it harvest the field. So, like, what we were like, we just kind of dumbfounded, like, what is going on? Why is all this wire showing up?
So the wire that was, in fact, found was stainless steel, so not magnetic. So this device was not picking up what was in the feed.
Correct.
And so when you found out that this is called lashing wire, which, if I hear it described right, is this wire that's used to, like, wrap bundles of telecommunication fiber?
That's my understanding. You have to secure it to the between the poles and stuff to align.
And so you started finding this, and then the cows started suffering. You could tell they were suffering.
Yeah, I started with just some going off feed. My first cow, Iva, I really started to notice her. She's the kind of cow that, you know, I mean, one of the lucky ones that ate everything in front of her and then some, and her neighbors too. She kind of went off to feed Thanksgiving Day, stopped eating her grain, stopped eating her hay and silage and all that stuff. Knew something was up. Then she just went downhill from there, and then she succumbed to the wire. And we just, you know, we've had a lot of abortions. We've had a lot of things that we've never had happen on our farm, or the history of the farm for that matter. And then it's just, you know, our vet's been out a bunch of times, and, you know, we did the article for Mont Digger, and he did his piece in there too, so...
Yeah, I know. Your phone's probably been ringing off the hook over the last couple of days. I really appreciate you giving us some time here today. And are you still experiencing issues with parts of your herd?
Yes. I mean, we figure we have about 70 animals that are still in our herd or so that have been exposed to the feed that was contaminated. So, and like this last cow, I think it was 3 weeks ago, ILAX passed 3 weeks ago on tomorrow. So she, you know, was out in the dry cow area, fat and happy, chewing her cud, looking good, coming to milk, calved in, had an unborn, stillborn calf. That was a little odd. So, like, what's going on? And then she started coming to milk, and it just stopped. And then next thing you know, she died in her stall, and we had the vet out for an emergency visit, and he found the wire.
And so once you, how did you discover what the nature of the wire was?
So... I mean, we knew in the fall of 2019, there was a telecom project, that we knew went across our property, running different lines and stuff like that. We went through the process of elimination and figuring things out. EC Fiber had hired Eustace Cable, who hired this Connor or Kramer Fiber Genesis out of New York to run these fiber optic cables and secure them to the lines. So we had our... We found the wire. We contacted EC Ag. I emailed EC Fiber support. They put me through to Eustace Cable. One of the owners of Eustace came out, and we started the process then. You know, I showed them what we found, the sections in the feed, the rolls we've been finding in the pasture. And he said, well, it's lashing wire. And the best explanation, what I understood from the situation was that they run this wire to secure the line, then somebody comes through and inspects it, and if it's not up to code, what happens is that they have to recut it, tie it up, tie it to the telephone pole, and they're supposed to take it out with them when they leave. And it must be by accident one of these pieces didn't get taken out, and that's how it ended up in our feed.
So is it a great deal of wire, or how much wire were we talking about, or do you have any idea of how much was actually left there to get chopped up?
Well, in the rolls we found, we're probably upwards of 100 feet, or a few hundred feet, maybe even into 1,000 feet of wire. And this is where, you know, it was presented as an accident. Okay, it was an accident, it fell down, you know, this is one-time thing. But the problem is, by the way we do things, we've kind of discovered that it's not an accident because, you know, I don't know if people are familiar how bunks are kind of packed, but, you know, you bring your feet in, you put it in your bunk, you layer it. You know, what's in the bottom of your bunk and the top of your bunk are not the same fields usually. And we were finding wire in different areas of the bunk when we're feeding out just based on how you feed out your feet. And so it had to be in multiple fields. The wire in our pasture is not nowhere near our crop fields, so it's a lot of that kind of stuff. Like, it was left everywhere, and that's why it's negligence. It wasn't just accidentally dropped in the snow or, you know, lost in transport. The amount of wire we're finding, and you know, I'm sure if we went up and dug through that, you know, 500 ton of feet or so that we've had to store on our land, we'll find more.
Have you inquired to look in other people's land to see if they've had a similar sort of left behind portion of wire where these projects have continued elsewhere in the region?
So I know, you know, personally, we have a lot of friends and family that have ties to Eustace. And out of that respect to those guys, we kind of, you know, and hearing from one of the owners saying I think it was an accident and how it happened, we can say, hey, let's not like jump the gun and, you know, blow this out of portion. Maybe it was just an accident, and we'll have, you know, we had Agency of Ag out, Clark Parmalee came out, did some pictures, did some statements, kind of looked into it, just, you know, and because, hey, we don't want to go forward with this and cause, you know, unnecessary harm to anybody. Let's have Clark, can you reach out and talk to some local farms, which he did. It sounds like maybe one farm in South Rolton found some wire, but other than that, it sounds like not the case.
So the Department of Agriculture, are they helping you? What sort of measures are they taking on your behalf?
They're just kind of observing as a third party, trying to stay neutral, I think, for the most part of it.
And the telecommunications company and the other company and the subcontractor, how have they responded to you?
Well, so when the first owner came out, did the look at, see what we had, said we'll be back, come out in a couple days, touch base with you, had scheduled time to come meet with us, postponed it again, then postponed another day, said that, oh, we've had companies come, we've had our crew walk the lines, we haven't, you know, I think it's just an isolated incident, and then a few weeks later, we got switched to a different owner in the company, and they took over from there, and then it became, you know, we want to make this right, we're willing to see, and I said, well, the immediate need is to get new feed for animals, so we don't have to feed the contaminated feed. By the time we had opened our second cut bunk and found wire in that, and then, you know, and obviously there must have been the third cut because the cow that died in April, Wally, hadn't been exposed to first or second cut.
Well, Scott, we're going to continue to follow this story because we're a locally owned business and we have a lot of respect for other locally owned businesses here in the area. And we love our dairy farmers and all the work they do. And we know it's hard enough work without having something like this come your way. So we're rooting for you and we hope you get a result that will work out as you would like it at this point, but I'm sure that even losing those cows, you kind of grow fond of them as you live with them and raise them from calves up to the milking level.
Absolutely. I mean, my wife took over the genetic program when we bought the farm, or back in 2014 before we moved back from Wisconsin, and when we bought the farm, she's even advanced then. It was a good base there, my folks' animals, and we really do care for them. We take them to the fair, we parade them around, we talk to them, we scratch them, we touch them every day. It's just, you know, it's heartbreaking, and, you know, and we love our animals, and for this to happen, and then for, you know, there being some misinformation out there, it sounds like, from in the local community, maybe, that this wire wasn't Eustace's wire, or this wire was fencing wire. It's not fencing. It's not, this is not magnetic. Fencing wire is magnetic, and, you know, it's disheartening. I mean, you know, we try to let people do the right thing, and we're going to end up, you know, suffering for years to come. I mean, this is not just going to be done overnight. Until all those cows are gone, and we've lost generations of genetics and our time, our effort, our, you know, our mind sometimes.
Well, Scott, I'm grateful for your time, and I look forward to talking with you again in the future and as updates as this situation unfolds. Best to you and Amber, and thanks once again for giving us some time here on WDEV.
Thank you for having us.
Bob Ney for our Friday morning report on the national scene. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Lee. How are you?
Good. I think it's been a couple years since I had a chance to talk to you on the air. Nice to be with you again. And, of
you
course,
too.
Plenty of news to talk about. The state of California is going back to a mask mandate.
Right. And I'm going to probably safely predict a couple of other states might. For example, Arkansas and Missouri, maybe a couple of them. What's basically happened is that, by the way, I should mention right off the bat, applause lines for your state here because they've done quite well. with the highest vaccination rate in America.
That's right. And Governor Scott, when he hit 80%, said that the COVID mandates would, the restrictions would be lifted. And I believe he also indicated that they would not be brought back. So somewhere down the road here, we may, that statement may have some pressure applied to it.
It may, because of other states. So what's happening is cases are surging in 49 states. And when I say surging, now they're 10% higher than a week ago, which was at a low bottom there. So, you know, we're not going 10% above the peak. We're going 10% above, you know, a low point, which is a little bit better for us, let's say. But what's going on is 38 states are seeing at least a 50% increase. And, of course, where this becomes a problem is it's not necessarily that type of higher death rate, but it's hospitalization usage. Missouri and Kansas are in problems. Now, Arkansas, only 35% of the population is fully vaccinated. But they are in pretty bad problems with utilization of hospital space. And now we've got an average of about 343,000 people vaccinated each day. But remember that about 2 months ago, we were at 1.3 million people. And we are at 48% nationwide. Bottom line is, remember the 70% herd immunity. We've got, you know, 20% up to go.
All right. And yesterday, kind of an interesting development in the press conference where Jen Psaki said that the government was looking to point out what they say is misinformation and going to the big tech giants to encourage them to take it, to take what they call misinformation down. And this is running counter to what Facebook has said recently, where they are they're an independent company making independent decisions, and now it appears like that may not be entirely the case.
Well, yes, and Facebook they're an independent company making independent decisions, but they are taking certain things down, or they put warnings. I have posted some things on my Facebook page that are statistically correct. They still put a little disclaimer sort of on it, you know, about what can be debated or not. But Facebook sort of picks and chooses when it's going to remove something, you know, and take it down. I think the White House is just trying to put more pressure on the tech community. But, you know, you've still got blogs and, you know, a lot of other ways people are communicating. But I guess the one thing that's looked at a lot is Facebook or Instagram.
And does this concern you, Bob, that the federal government is making efforts to take down what they perceive as misinformation, when even the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health have kind of flexed what they've said were the policies or the correct tactics to take regarding coronavirus several times since last March?
Well, it does bother me because in my time in the U.S. Congress, for example, I had made a statement that was very controversial about a offer that was made from Iran to the United States. I was told that, you know, I was not telling the truth and, you know, things like that. Later on in testimony in the Senate, it was admitted that, yes, this deal was offered. So I'm sitting here thinking to myself, okay, if I posted that at that time, and there was a Facebook at that time, would somebody say, well, that's misinformation, I'm taking that down? I mean, who's to say what's correct? Usually you can go in and you can debate it as citizens with each other. If somebody posts on Facebook, there's usually somebody else that will come along and say, no, wait a minute, you know, this is what is accurate or not. So I think when it comes to, you know, certain threats, hate speech, et cetera, threats towards people, that's one thing to intervene. I'm just not sure that it's the ability of these tech corporations to say, well, this is what we deem to be correct, because obviously some things that, you know, I've dealt with in the past, they would probably be deemed to be incorrect, yet we needed to put that information out there because it was correct, if that makes sense.
Oh, well, it's kind of hard to make sense of everything that's coming out of Washington these days, Bob. But, you know, we all do what we can. You know, with that Senate divided 50-50, it's very hard to reach unanimity on anything. But all the senators who voted Wednesday unanimously passed a bill that would ban the importation from all the products from a certain region of China due to the forced labor and genocide of Uyghurs and other minorities in the region. But my question to you, Bob, is if we're going to ban these products, we're already dealing with supply chain issues in all sorts of products and components that we need from this country. So isn't banning some of these products coming in from China going to exacerbate problems that already exist economically in this country?
Well, yes, and of course, this is a tough one because of the genocide on the Uyghurs by the Chinese government. But then again, if we don't have, you know, some type of process or plan where we're going to substitute what's missing in the supply chain, then American companies are going to put something together. They'll have 278 parts and are missing the one part. They have 277, they're missing one of them, and it's in China. So I think, hopefully, somebody's going to get bright enough in the Congress or maybe the White House to really get down to the details and say, here are our essential supply chain items in this country. You know, who wants to make them? How can we help you to get started? I would hope that would happen, because you're right. If we just ban things and we don't have the ability to fill in the pieces in the supply chain, then we're going to be in trouble.
Well, in trouble by, you mean a potential national security issue?
Yes, a lot of issues that, you know, obviously with COVID and because of China's position at the time of, you know, having the COVID begin there and their trucks were stopped, et cetera, we really felt the pinch all the way around of supplies vanishing off the shelves for a while. And so, again, I hope we learn from those lessons and we can recreate our own products where we have stopped doing them. But, you know, we'll see if somebody wants to take that issue up or not.
Bob Ney, a treat to spend some time with you, sir. Very much appreciated today.
Thank you, Lee.
All right, Bob Ney here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV FM and AM. Coming up in the next hour, Robert Haidu, who is teaching a seminar with the University of Vermont Continuing Education Program about the history of capitalism. Get ready, folks. We're going to jump in the time machine and go back, about 400, 500 years as we continue here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, FM, and AM. And again, you are invited to be part of the conversation. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We'll be back on Vermont Viewpoint after we step into the newsroom.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, FM, and AM. Lee Cattell in for Rick Sangeri. He's taking his family, his visiting him in Vermont for the first time. What a treat that is. Life as we know it here in the Green Mountains. And by the way, tomorrow morning, you're all invited to join us as we celebrate our 90th anniversary of broadcasting. And we're going to move the studio right outside of our offices here on Stowe Street. They're closing down the street, and we're going to have a big old celebration down there. So, yes, we're going to have cake and, you can have a bagel for breakfast if you want, but we're also serving up cake and a chance for folks to win a $550 prize. $550 in honor of the Nifty 550, where you can find us on the AM dial. So we look forward to seeing you tomorrow morning. We'll be broadcasting out there starting at 8 a.m. with the bonus trading post right up through about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We'll conclude with the Rick and the Ramblers performing live outside there. Oh, it's going to be a great day, and we hope you'll join us, and good luck in winning our cash prize for just stopping on by to say hello here at WDEV FM and AM. Coming up on Monday, I've got a couple of terrific guests coming up. Steve Shepard is a college professor, a business owner, and he is an author of a book called The Nation We Once Knew, which recently was the number one political fiction novel on Amazon. So he's had a bit of success with his latest effort. He's written lots of books. He knows a lot about trends and demographic developments, and he's incorporated a lot of that into his new book, which I'm leafing through through these last couple of days. Stephen Shepard will join me, and also Professor Joshua, I'm going to butcher his last name, I don't have it in front of me, I think it's Bromberg, who's at the University of Vermont, and he is a professor who's doing research on xenobots, which are computer-generated microscopic organisms that are used in, well, we'll find out what they're using them for, but he's doing the research on it, and he's going to join me on Monday, too. That should be a fascinating program. Joining me right now in studio is Robert Haidu, who is teaching a seminar with the University of Vermont Continuing Education about the history of capitalism. Robert, good morning. Thanks for coming into the studio today.
Good morning, Lee. It's good to be here.
I see you gazing around at all of the wonderful items we have here in the Dump Show studio, the red Solo cup light display. And
I wish I knew the names of everything.
Yeah.
The red Solo cup. Got it.
It's all a very unique place here at WDEV, and we're glad to have you a part of it. And you are going to be teaching a seminar at University of Vermont Continuing Education. Folks out there who are listening that want to take a couple of classes. This is big news because the governor recently announced a grant program where people can take classes to continue their education. And so there's a great opportunity for a lot of people out there who want to learn more about lots of things that can do so by taking part in that grant program and taking some classes at UVM and some of the other higher education institutions in Vermont. And the continuing education program at UVM has a great deal to offer. So, Robert, you're going to be teaching about the history of capitalism. And I guess I would like to ask you first, what happened before capitalism? What kind of system did we use for transactions?
Well, let's say that capitalism started in the middle of the 15th century in Western Europe. Prior to that, let me give you a brief history.
Sure.
Just in 1 minute. The Roman Empire in the West fell in the 6th century. It disappeared, sort of. It disintegrated. It was invaded and disintegrated into several different countries. The next 500 years, I'm speaking broad brushing
sure.
here, the next 500 years are known as the Dark Ages. And during that period, the economy was totally local. Very, very, very few things were transported and sold away from the place where they had been grown or made. And very few things were grown, and very few things were made in addition.
This would come as a tremendous culture shock to the folks of a 21st century sensibility where you walk into a grocery store and you see items, your fish is from Peru and your oranges come from all over. Things come from all over the country, and it's all brought to us on a regular basis around here. But when you go back that far, everything that you were able to buy was made probably in the village where you lived.
Exactly, exactly. And let me add, when you bought something, you probably didn't pay with it, pay for it with money.
You bartered.
You bartered. People basically, I mean, didn't know money. They just, they lived without the knowledge, most ordinary people. Obviously, the kings knew what money was, but they also didn't rely on money. They received services from their vassals, as we would say, in kind. The military service was a duty of the knights, And it was only in the 12th century that in some countries the suggestion was made that maybe the military service duty should be commuted, as we say, into a money payment. So the Diet Knight didn't have to leave the Mrs. Knight at home and go away for a three-month campaign. Instead, he paid a certain amount of money to the king, who hired a mercenary. Nice. Anyway, we're digressing.
Okay, well, we're trying to cover 1,500 years of history in 16.
Yes.
It's hard to do, but also prior to a modern monetary system existing, I bet people had to learn the art of haggling, because what is your chicken worth? How many loaves of bread is
Absolutely.
Your chicken worth?
And, absolutely. And one would imagine that values were very local. It's not like whether you buy it in this store or you buy it in the next store, assuming that stores existed, they would have the same price. Nothing like that. No competition, really. No economic competition. And that's one of the big pieces of news about capitalism. Prior to capitalism, since that's the question you asked me, what we had. So, wait, let me continue. So, the Dark Ages lasted until about a year 1000, roughly speaking. Mm-hmm. Then there was a revival of the economy throughout Europe. And with that revival, people started producing things. The economy became, let's call it regional. It wasn't international yet, certainly. But the economy was rebuilding, picking up. There was more commerce. Things were good, and they kept improving until about the year 1350, when the Black Death came to Europe. That destroyed everything.
Wiped out about a third of the population?
Exactly, exactly. So let's say that following the arrival of the Black Death about 1350, for a century, there was a recession in Europe. Things went backward. All that loss of population, all that loss of productivity, the fear of going out, not having any idea. We know what a pandemic is like now. Mm-hmm. We don't know what it was like back in the 14th century.
That's for sure.
Now, here. So let's say at 1450 is when capitalistic urges first start appearing. And the economy, first of all, becomes more complex. The division of labor becomes more finely tuned. For example, it was in the latter part of the 15th century that there was a distinction made between wholesalers of products and retailers. Until then, that distinction did not exist. Now, if you think about it, when you have these different steps in the, I heard you talking about the supply chain mm-hmm. a few minutes ago, so to speak, then, and you get to the top of that chain, you come to the people at this time who basically just have the capital to invest. And that is the beginning of capitalism, one part of it. Capitalism came, first of all, you have to ask, well, where did the capital come from to begin with, to start capitalism? Historians used to think that prior to about that time, let's say 1450, there really was no capital in Europe, meaning that there were no savings. Capital is basically savings. People make money, whatever they have left, they save, and that can be used as capital. The concept of capital was known, well known by that time. But certain estimates that have been made, because this is the evidence for this type of stuff is very, very thin. It has been calculated or estimated, or the hypothesis proposed that during the 15th century, the beginning of the 15th century, the elites in countries like England, France, Spain, Italy, Germany, these are the places we're talking about primarily, during that time, the elite in the country, the people who did have some wealth, were about 5% of the population, and they had about 25% of the income of the country annually. Then it has been further calculated that out of the 25%, we're talking on a national scale here, 16% were necessary for these elite, this elite class to maintain its style of life, which left sort of 9%, which one could say was savings. But back in those days, capital products, not machinery, but wooden machinery that you might have, had to be fixed very frequently because those things went to ruin much faster than after industrialization. That cost some money. So let's say at the end of the year, 6% was in savings. There was 6% of the annual income of the country available to be used as capital. But there was no capitalism. And the question is, why not? And the answer is, there was no capitalism because there were no investment opportunities where it was worth your money to go after the profit. Profits were so small because everything was local. So rich people built palaces. They just left their money sitting around because they had nothing better to do with it. Then came ocean navigation. Columbus, Vasco da Gama, who went to India, as you may recall, a few years after Columbus came to America. And they started, not so much from America, but from Asia, expensive products started coming to Europe, were being imported by European merchants.
Right, not just expensive, but in many ways exotic.
Exactly. And much, much, much desired in Europe, especially spices, which were considered to be medicinal in many, many cases during the 16th century. So Portuguese merchants went to India, and they imported these spices into Europe. And as you can imagine, when they got to Europe with these products, they could charge for it whatever they wanted, whatever the traffic would bear, because there was no competition. Nobody knew what values were. So the possibility of making a really fat profit first appeared. You could invest your money. You could invest your money in a ship that was going as part of a fleet, a Portuguese ship, going to India to bring back spices. Take European trinkets there and trade it for spices. Came back to Lisbon. It was transported throughout Europe, and people made 10 times their investment. All of a sudden, all that money that was sitting there, and it may not have been a large amount, all of a sudden, rich people wanted to invest their money because for the first time, it made sense.
And with the division of labor, that meant more shipbuilders, more sailors, and more opportunities for them to make money. Of course, more risk. A lot of those ships were not exactly very seaworthy, and that was a lot of ocean to cover.
Yes, excellent point. There was an enormous amount of risk with long-distance trade, but the possibilities of profit were just spectacular. I mean, they were so spectacular that the risk-taking urge in people, in those people who have the risk-taking urge, let's say, they could not resist. The fruit hanging from the tree was so appealing that we see the first stirrings of capitalism.
Oh, Robert, a couple of questions. As we talked about the growth of shipping and international trade starting to change the world, a couple of thoughts here. Who are the capitalists, and how did capitalism change the communities where it was brought in?
Who were the capitalists? Let's deal with that first. with capitalism, a new kind of person, sorry to put it in such general terms, appeared in European society. And he was the entrepreneur. Until then, going back to your original question, what the economy was like before capitalism appeared, there were no entrepreneurs. Things basically didn't change over the hundreds and hundreds of years in what constituted the economy. Now, there were always merchants, After about the year 1000, there were merchants who would, for example, there was the Silk Road trade that came in from China and India during the Middle Ages. That was conducted mostly by Arabs until the goods reached Alexandria, Egypt. Once they reached Alexandria, Egypt, then Venetian merchants picked up the stuff in Alexandria. They took it back to Venice, and from there, they sent it up into Northern Europe. So these products were already in Europe, the exotic products from the East, but they were extremely expensive. And they were very rare, and therefore even more expensive. Now, with Europeans bringing in these things, and not necessarily into Alexandria, but into Lisbon, or later on stuff from the Americas to Seville, the whole trading situation changed, meaning that merchants began to appear in those parts of Europe which parts of Europe they had not frequented before, because there were more products and there was more interest in them, and there was a profit to be made in more places now. And the entrepreneur, the most common label for the leading entrepreneurs, capitalist entrepreneurs in Europe in the 16th century was wholesale merchant. These men were capitalist venturers. They did not bring anything to the economy. They produced nothing. All they did was invest their money in certain ventures, skim off the fat, obviously, get richer and richer, but they were the engines of the new economy. By the end of the 16th century, these people established what today is referred to as a middle class, a commercial bourgeoisie, which had not existed up until that time. So the world is changing very significantly. The leaders in many parts of society are no longer titled people, are no longer men good with the sword or military commanders. Instead, they were investors.
And this might have brought a bit of wealth into locations outside of the palace.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The luxurious products, you see, products of the Renaissance, not only in Italy, but also in the Low Countries, in Holland and what later on became Belgium, in southern Germany, where there were a number of commercial cities like Augsburg and Nuremberg, which were great centers of trade and great centers of wealth. Let me give you an example. There was a man named Jacob Fugger, who was from Augsburg in southern Germany, in Bavaria. He died in 1525. He started out in business with his family business when he was 14 years old. He was sent from Augsburg at age 14 to Venice to manage the company's local offices in Venice. He was sort of a child prodigy. And many people, or it's many people, the general opinion amongst historians about Jacob Fugger, that when he died in 1525, he was probably the richest man who had ever lived. Who had ever lived and who would live, who ever lived from our viewpoint. They figured out that his wealth when he died, which we know from the estate papers, which were filed even in those days, we know that his assets were 2 million guilders, which is calculated to be the equivalent of $400 billion today.
Wow. Well, that's more than the richest man in America, or the richest man on the planet has currently.
Barring Vladimir Putin, whose numbers we don't know.
Well, you know, the really rich know how to hide their assets, don't they?
Yes,
We're talking with Robert Haidu. He's teaching a seminar with the University of Vermont Continuing Education Program about the history of capitalism here on the Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV FM and AM. I'm Lee Cattell, filling in for Rick and Gary. You can be part of the show if you have a question for Robert. You are encouraged at 244-1777, toll-free from everywhere, even in Lisbon and all points around the world. 877-291-8255, Vermont Viewpoint, a trip to the newsroom, and then we're back with more on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We're getting a lesson in European history and the history of capitalism here on WDEV with Robert Haidu, who's teaching a seminar at the UVM Continuing Education Program about this very topic. You can go to uvm.edu to sign up or register and spend more time with Mr. Haidu, who, when we last left, was talking about Jacob Fugger, the richest man in the world, as a result of his forays into international shipping.
And let me add something to that, Lee. Capitalists were the first bankers in the modern world. Obviously, if you got capital, you're going to become a bank. You're going to lend people money, or otherwise, you could say you're going to invest in. And by the way, let me add, one of the things that capitalism created, or one of the things that came into existence at the time when capitalism originated, was the idea of credit. Now, as we know, the modern world cannot operate without credit. Prior to the appearance of credit, when you went into a venture, you used only your own money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the wholesale merchant, when the idea of credit came about, what it meant is that the wholesale merchant could multiply his profit by a factor of 4 to 5, which basically means that you had to put down either between 20% and 25%, right? 4 to 5 when you... So that, again, brought enormous amounts of capital into circulation in Europe. And in a way, this all built on itself, as you can see. But let me get back to Jacob Fugger. So Fugger was a banker, and fairly early on in his career, his bank and he himself became connected with the Habsburg family. Habsburg family of Holy Roman Empire fame and Kings of Spain fame, the greatest, probably the greatest dynasty of rulers in Europe in the 16th century. one of the stars of the family was a man whom we usually refer to as the Emperor Charles V, who was King of Spain and King of Germany under the title Holy Roman Emperor. People were concerned that he wanted to consolidate his power and rule all of Europe, which he claims was never his idea. But Jacob Fugger early on became Charles's banker. Charles fought wars all his life because everybody else in Europe was out to get him, thinking that he was out to get them. You know, he was already...
Sounds like a paranoid time in Europe.
No more paranoid than international relations today,
I would say.
And maybe a little bit more honest. Charles V was a devout Christian. Just a little side note about him. When Spain already had an empire in the Americas, there was a dispute in Spain as to how the Native Americans or the indigenous people should be treated. And Charles declared that until a learned debate can be arranged on how they should be treated, can they be made into slaves? Can they be made into something like serfs? Can they be converted to Christianity by using force? How much Christianity do they have to understand before they are baptized? He said that Spain will conquer no more of the Americas until that debate takes place, because he wants to be sure that everything is done properly. And properly means according to the tenets of Christianity. Hmm. And when I say tenets of Christianity, it wasn't just convert everybody, but also once they have Christian ideas, then you have converted them, not simply when you sprinkle some water on them. And as historians have said, when was the last time that it happened that an emperor stopped conquering until it was decided whether the conquests were just or not? These are some of the people we are dealing with. Very different thinking. Anyway, back to Jacob.
One moment. We'll get to Jacob in a moment, but I have invited our listeners in to ask questions. So let's go to the phones. 244-1777. Linda from Addison, you're on with Robert Hajdu. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm kind of late to the conversation, but it's really very, very interesting. And I wondered if Robert could comment at all about when tulips were so valuable in the Netherlands and probably beyond, because that just seems like a crazy thing to have happened.
Yes, yes. Hi, Linda. The tulip mania happened during the 17th century, and it was basically what today we would call a stock market bubble. The value of tulip bulbs on the market by 1622, there is the leading stock exchange in Europe was in Amsterdam. The Dutch were in the forefront of organizing finance throughout the continent, and that's where this happened. And what happened is that basically people believed that these things are going to get more and more valuable, and they did get more and more valuable because they bid up the price, needless to say, and then the whole thing burst. And it was a complete mania, like you said. And these kinds of things happened sort of periodically in European history, as they keep happening today. In 1720, there was an event. I don't know if you can call it an event or an episode that is known as the Mississippi Bubble. Some speculators in Europe were putting together a consortium collecting money, in other words, from investors, with the idea of going, coming to what is the United States now, but wasn't then, exploiting the Mississippi Valley, where they were going to, from which they were going to extract incredible amounts of wealth for a very low cost. And enormous amounts of money were collected. The first pioneers came to the Mississippi Valley, and they saw that it was coming to nothing, and the whole thing collapsed. Mm. People lost their money.
They thought they had a good idea, but what, geographical circumstances or opposition from the natives in the area at the time?
But keep in mind that America was still very far away from Europe in those days, unlike mm-hmm. today. And people believed all kinds of things about America. After all, that's the country where the Spanish found untold amounts.
Ah.
Well, that's the place, untold amounts of silver and gold. People would believe if you said that the Mississippi Valley is the next place where you're going to get rich. And you didn't. Unless you got out before the crash.
Another caller left with a question about you mentioned the term bourgeoisie, but that didn't actually come about until the 16th century. You said it was a little bit earlier than that.
No, 16th century, I said.
Okay.
That answers the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought you said, according to what I'm reading here, it was mentioned the bourgeoisie in the 11th century, or is that just moving a term to a different era?
No, I would say merchant class maybe in the 11th century. Even more correctly, I would say townspeople, the people who started living in the towns that were appearing in the 11th century as nodes of commerce.
Let's go back to Jacob
Fugger.
Fugger.
So early on, Jacob became Charles V's banker. He was the guy who was bankrolling Charles in his various wars. Now, Charles became king of Spain in 1516. Then his grandfather, one of his grandfathers, who had been Holy Roman Emperor, he died, and the emperor's position was an elective position for many, many centuries. There were seven great noblemen in Germany who constituted what today we would call the Electoral College. They got together and they decided who's going to be the next emperor. And as you can imagine, these were people whose opinions were easily moved with the right kind of cash mm-hmm. or whatever. So it was very important to Jacob Fugger that Charles V become emperor, because the benefits to Jacob that his client would be emperor was worth enormous amounts of money. So Jacob advanced 500,000 guilders, a vast fortune, to Charles to use to bribe the electors so that he would be elected emperor, and so he was.
Wow. That's that's 500 years ago, an example of the sort of election finance, fundraising issues that we still deal with today.
Absolutely. And let me just change the conversation a little bit, since you also asked me how capitalism, budding capitalism, changed the world. Let me give you a short list of the various institutions that were established during the 16th century, the first full century of capitalism, that were the creation of capitalism, and you will see that they are still the basis of our financial world today. Okay. First of all, a money economy was introduced. And since Europeans quickly started keeping all their records in terms of the money economy, and they calculated all values in terms of cash. How many guilders is this worth? Not how many bags of flour or something like that. But all of a sudden, people realized that doing accounting in terms of numbers and of one unit of currency, a single unit of currency, made everything comprehensible. So not only did European countries adopt the money economy, but they imposed that money economy on all the world they came in contact with, because the Portuguese started valuing products in India in terms of guilders or pounds or whatever their currency was. So the Indians whom they were dealing with also had to convert to that. So there is that, which is not a small thing, obviously. Next, markets appeared. Not only the stock market, but let's say that today we live in a world which is a generalized market. People are entering into exchanges everywhere today. Vermont is probably not as much affected by that, I would say, as many other places, because I think we live sort of a simpler kind of life. But basically, the world is just a zillion exchanges going on every minute. I mean, with Amazon, one need not say anymore. Markets changed significantly in the 16th century. Specialized markets appeared. Markets, instead of being fairs, held once every 6 months in a big meadow outside of your city, they became covered halls, or they became like the Amsterdam Stock Market, for example, which was a grand building. Markets appeared in order to serve the purposes of capitalism.
So instead of saving up to do your transactions at one particular day twice a year, you could go to some place any particular day,
exactly,
and get it done.
Exactly. And people who travel to your city, let's say merchants to Amsterdam, to do business with you, to get products that you got from, came through Portugal up to Amsterdam from India, they could go there any time of the year.
Robert, when we took off for a moment there, you were talking about some of the institutions that were transformed or created during the 1500s with the onset of capitalist systems.
Let me add a few things to that. Banking, we talked about for a minute already. Definitely credit, which is one of the engines of the economy today and has been for a while. If you know what a limited liability company is, let's say until the 15th century, all the various companies we come across, the members have joint liability for all the debts and all the obligations of the company. During the 16th century, the limited liability company is invented. In other words, there are one or two people who have liability for the whole business. The other people, the other members of the company, are just investors. They are putting only their investment on the line rather than everything they have. Now, this thing was created, the limited liability company, not in order to make it easier for the owners so that everybody shouldn't be liable. It was created because the shares could be sold. It was an other investment vehicle, as we call it today.
Is the one of the complaints about the way the current economic system is structured is that a lot of times the way it's set up, the losses for companies are spread out among mm-hmm. the population, and the people that run the company don't often have to face any sort of deficit as a result of it.
Well, if you have a joint liability company, which is everybody's liable, then you just divide the liability up amongst all the owners and everybody bears his or her share. limited liability is accepted. It is set up with the idea. We're not talking about joint stock companies yet, which is what the kind of company stream that are whose shares are sold on the market. Those are joint stock companies. And that's where this problem comes up. Joint stock companies came into being only at the beginning of the 17th century because they had to be licensed by the kingdom. So Queen Elizabeth I established the East India Company, mm-hmm. which then colonized India. The Dutch East India Company was formed in 1602. These are all joint stock companies, which means that their shares are sold on the market and anybody can buy them. Let me address another issue, since I see that our time is running out. The future of capitalism. My view is that capitalism is here to stay. And my view is also that there's nothing wrong with capitalism. There's something wrong, however, with the politics. Capitalism has to be regulated. If you regulate capitalism properly, the kind of situations we find ourselves in constantly should not be happening. Income inequality would be greatly reduced. But capitalism has to stay because it is only capitalism that makes possible the standard of living that we have and the whole world aspires to. If you don't have credit, for example, if you merely have to run the economy on the basis of the actual value of things that exist now, if you don't allow banks to take risks and invest in ventures, which is what credit is, essentially, then you have cut the wealth of the world by a factor of 4 or 5, and then all of us who desire to be cannot be middle class. Let's just put it that way.
Robert Haidu, he's going to be teaching a seminar. Our time has come up today, but he's teaching a seminar with the University of Vermont Continuing Education Program about the history of capitalism. UVM.edu if you'd like to sign up and take part in his program. Robert, I very much appreciate the time, and it's hard to cover 500 years of history
in
1 hour, but I think we did a pretty good job here. And thank you for joining us. Look forward to chatting again in the future.
Yes, I would like that. Thank you very much, Lee. It's been a pleasure.
We will be back on Monday morning here on the stations of Radio Vermont, WDEV, FM, and AM. I'll be filling in for Rick for that day. He'll be back on Tuesday right here on these stations coming up on 11 o'clock.